a lot of fun.
Hello, and welcome to Barks Remarks, the podcast where we talk about the stories from the legendary Carl Barks, creator of Scrooge McDuck and writer and artist of the greatest Donald and Scrooge comics of all time. Join us as we explore his longer adventure stories in their chronological publishing order. We'll talk about what makes them so enduring, their historical context, and how well they hold up today. So get out your reprint and get ready to enjoy our remarks.
This is Mark. Just wanted to cut in before the podcast and people know that
we're talking about Voodoo Hoodoo today, which is a story that has some content based on some deeply racist tropes and imagery. I wanted to provide this as both a content warning, and I also wanted to explicitly repeat something that I don't get to say in the episode until near the very end, which is that while I do enjoy many aspects of this story, I consider it largely unredeemable from a modern context.
Voodoo Hoodoo is obviously a very problematic story, and I'm grateful to Sarah for helping me process it. We really want to recognize, you know, we're going to do our best to talk about this one in a thoughtful, sensitive manner. But, you know, by nature of what happens in this story, it's going to be difficult not to talk about it in a way that might be upsetting. And we want to convey our intentions and not to use problematic language as much as possible. Sarah, can you chime in?
Yeah, Mark and I are doing our best, but we are not Black people. We are not experts, and we don't wish to speak for people who are. We are representing the position of people who are doing our best and have a pretty good idea of what is upsetting, but we obviously will get it wrong because we are not perfect.
Yes, thank you. Very well said. That said, enjoy our conversation.
Hello and welcome back to Barks Remarks. I'm Mark Severino, a longtime Carl Barks fan. I enjoy talking about these Golden Age Donald Duck and now Uncle Scrooge comics with guest hosts that have never read them. And I've got a returning guest host today. I'll let her introduce herself.
Hi, I'm Sarah Santiago. I've been here before, and I'm not generally a fan of comics, but I think I've read more comics for your podcast than I ever have in my entire life combined.
Excellent. So we're expanding horizons here on Barks Remark.
Yeah.
And I've had you come back for several of these. Number one, because I think you've got a great voice for it. Just number two, I think you're really good at helping me process some of these really challenging stories. And we have a doozy of a challenging story today. We're going to be talking about Carl Barks' Voodoo Hoodoo. I think we're both going to have a lot to say because this one is probably his most controversial story, I would say. And again, I think you're really good at processing these stories, and you don't have some of the baggage of, I first read this one in 1989 before I had some awareness of some of the challenges. Sarah, what are kind of some of your initial impressions just before I even get into the details of the story?
I started in my notes writing a yikes for each individual yikes, and The yikes per page average was getting so high that my hand was getting tired, so I gave up on that. It's a very high average yikes per page in this comic.
Yeah. So I guess a disclaimer right away, right? We're going to acknowledge that this story was created in 1949. We are talking about it in 2021. I'm not saying that we're going to excuse it for its very challenging content, but we're going to recognize that it did come out of a different world. It came out of a culture in which the racial caricatures and depictions were widespread, almost universal across the comics industry at this time. However, there were definitely creators at the margins who were not engaging in these kinds of tropes. And that's important to say too, because we should recognize that, you know, it's not out of our control, and that there are people in those earlier times who did get it right. I think we're going to be very critical of this story. I have a little more baggage with it, right? Because I read it so young, before I had real awareness of some of the problematic content. So I might be a little bit more defensive of it. That's not to say that I don't see a lot to criticize in it. So Sarah, I sent you scans from the recent Fantagraphics reprint. I thought it was important to do that because that one presented it as it was originally published, right? And Karl Barks wouldn't have had anything to do with the coloring decisions that were made in that one. But subsequent reprintings of Voodoo Hoodoo will have included significant censoring, right? So the version that I read in 1989, which was published by Gladstone, made some edits to kind of remove some of the racial caricatures of some of the African characters. It would have downplayed, at least, like the oversized lips, kind of the racialized dialect. However, it made a couple of edits that Barks wished he could have done, right? Weirdly, his publishers asked him not to refer to characters as being dead. So in the version, Sarah, that you read, they're referred to as done for, right? Anytime you see done for, yeah. he originally wrote it as dead. I guess it's a good time also to talk about one other change that was foisted upon Barks. He originally drew Bombi the zombie as having kind of vacant, glassy eyes, but his editors objected to this, and they asked him to give him, or they put in some pupils for this one to make him look a little bit less menacing. Maybe it's because I read it that way originally, but I think I prefer that because I think it gives Bombi the zombie like more of a lovable, sleepy look to him.
Yeah, he does have pretty droopy eyelids. Yeah, he looks just kind of sleepy and tired.
Right. And then one of the really notable things about this story is that this is the first instance where Barks is going to show a character that's coded as African-American. Right? Bop Bop on the very first page. I had no idea in my printing because, again, they kind of took out his dialect and they colored him, coded as, quote, white. And so, you know, in that one, he kind of just comes across as like a juvenile, eccentric person. Whereas I think the intent in Bark's original one is to just show kind of a, quote, average African-American, like a jazz musician, again, who is coded as being immature. It's still a very stereotyped representation, but I definitely think that Barks was kind of trying to inoculate himself from only having, you know, sinister Black characters in that one.
I did have a question about Bop Bop, because he had the stereotypical minstrel, white mouth, black face appearance. And I wanted to ask about that. You know, how intentional was that? Was it changed in the revised versions?
Yeah. So let me do our background details. And then why don't we talk about that? It's just since he comes up right on that first page, right?
Sure.
Yeah, because Bop Bop, for his like just two frames of appearance, is really interesting. I think he says a lot about Barks' intentions with this story. So let's go ahead. Boy, I have a lot to say about this one, and I'm sure you do too.
Okay, right.
So Voodoo Hoodoo was its cover date is August 1949. You know, we're still we're roaring into the 50s. We're still definitely in that post-war era. Very crucially for this story, we're in a very like post-colonial era, right? Because these are kind of the waning days of colonialism. Not that colonialism and its effects are ever going to truly wane, but this was published in 4-color 238. It has maybe more reprints than you might guess. There are 7, including the original in the United States, at least. And this one is a 32-pager. It's definitely one of his longer ones. I'll just give a synopsis. As Donald and the boys travel to Africa to attempt to lift a voodoo curse. And that's a pretty anodyne representation of the story, so we'll get much more into detail. All right, so for a little bit of background trivia, right away, I would characterize that this one really stands out as being one of Carl Barks' most horrific stories, right? You were here for the Old Castle Secret, which, you know, he drew some inspiration from like the old EC horror comics. I would say that this one maybe wears its horror movie DNA even more so than that one. And he was inspired directly by the famous old classic zombie movie, the Bela Lugosi film, White Zombie, you know, which is where the rock band also took their name from. That one came out way back in 1932. And there was this like really spooky scene. I had never seen this before. And I watched a clip of this scene last night. And it's pretty haunting, where there's like this sugar mill that is being run by zombies, right? The zombies are providing the labor for it. And every once in a while, one of the zombies will kind of just stumble and fall placidly into the machinery and just be ground up. You know, they don't show you any gore, but they really don't need to, because you know what happened. Just to see that happen, it was very, very creepy. I recommend any listeners check it out. You can find it pretty easily on YouTube. Obviously, something that stuck with Carl Barks when he saw it. He was quoted as saying, every few seconds, a zombie would lose his footing and fall into the grinder, where he silently got ground into hamburger. I became convinced that zombies do not feel, and I set out to preach their virtues as ideal stooges for anyone who needed a dangerous job done cheaply. And and further inspiration came from a painting that Carl Barks saw in a publication called The American Weekly. It accompanied a story called I Met a Zombie. And, you know, he kind of toned down the like gruesome appearance, but he got some inspiration for Bombi in that one.
Right now might be a good time to kind of talk about the origins of the zombie myth, archetype, entity. They're a part of Haitian voodoo culture, and they are specifically a reanimated corpse. And so I thought it was really interesting that in the comic book, they referred to him as done for,
right,
instead of saying that he was a reanimated corpse. And then they said that once the, you know, whatever zombie potion wears off, that he'll have a nice and full life, because that's not how the, you know, original zombie kind of works. Yeah. I do want to take a second to point out too that there's a difference between hoodoo religion and voodoo religion. They're both diasporic religions that were created, that grew in enslaved people's communities based on West and Central African like religions that were, you know, brought along with the slaves.
Right.
But they were not necessarily practiced in Africa themselves, although voodoo was based more directly on an African religion. Hoodoo was purely a North American offspring.
So my understanding is that a hoodoo is like a curse, right? But called hoodoo.
Hoodoo, yeah.
Oh, yeah,
and
you're
it's very similar, and it's the way that it's kind of enmeshed with Christianity is quite interesting too. The way that I was kind of seeing this was that voodoo was wrapped up more with Catholicism, and hoodoo tied into Protestantism.
Yeah, so that's interesting. See, I knew that voodoo, of course, had like this rich history, right? And like you say, it's kind of centered around Haiti, but it does bring in a lot of elements of these like very old African traditions. But it is mostly through Haiti, which is not mentioned here at all. I've seen hoodoo used in comics of this era as kind of a noun. So I think that it has like a colloquial definition as curse.
No, absolutely right. But it's not necessarily evil in the way white Eurocentric American Christians like to take the evil elements of other people's religions and import them into their stories.
Yeah, and that's a really important point that you're making, right? Because both of these belief systems are things that have been given this really sinister tinge. Immediately you say voodoo. I don't know about you, but growing up, if I heard the word voodoo, it just had this very dark, mysterious, evil connotation. But it's just another belief system that has a very specific set of values that has been coded as evil because of white fear of Black power, I would say, and Black agency.
I would say that too. I think that as kids who grew up, you know, in primarily Christian churches and communities, we are kind of brought up to believe that any kind of witchcraft at all is quote unquote evil.
Right.
And then as we've grown older, and I don't know about you, but I've met so many practitioners of witchcraft from all over, so many varying practices, and all of them have experienced marginalization because of the witchcraft element, but it's a very specific type of marginalization as far as these Black practitioners of.
Yeah, I think the key is that Christianity was really suspicious of any religion that seemed to like revel in animacy, kind of elevating the natural world, which of course voodoo does. And yeah,
another element too is that hoodoo was created specifically by enslaved African Americans as a resistance.
And I see, you know, one line that Wikipedia has that just says the word hoodoo means spirit work. So yeah, you're absolutely right. Oh, you know, it's also just briefly, we'll note, of course, that like in these days, we hear zombie and we immediately have another idea of like a kind of movie monster zombie, right? So this doesn't even touch on that element of zombies in pop culture. That came out of George Romero's Night of the Living Dead. That hasn't come out yet. I do think it's neat to see this other take on a zombie. And you know what Barks is going to do in this story is he's going to mine the kind of idea of a zombie as a boogeyman. It's impossible to remove it from some of these like cultural anchors. But you know, I think he saw that movie. He thought this would make a really interesting idea. I'm going to craft this story. And of course, I'm going to use these tropes that all of these other comic creators are doing. And I'm going to give it this little veneer of science and make a memorable story out of it. So I also think when we talk about the background to this story, that it is set in, quote, Africa, right? Generic Africa. This is something that Westerners almost always do. You know, my reading of the story is that it's meant to be somewhere around what is today what the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Part of the setting is at a rubber plantation, which has its own very dark history. And then the word zombie itself was first recorded in 1819 in a history of Brazil by the poet Robert Southey in the form of zombie without an E. And it actually is thought to refer to the Afro-Brazilian rebel leader named Zumbi. But you already mentioned it very well. But in Haitian folklore, a zombie is an animated corpse raised by magical means such as witchcraft. All right. So I see as far as some other translations around the world that when it was first published in Brazil, it had the more anodyne title Donald na Africa, Donald in Africa. That's in Portuguese. I see that its first Danish publication used the same title, Voodoo Hoodoo. I see in Finland, in Finnish, in 1972, it was published as Aku Anka which I think is the word for Donald Duck, Ya Zombie, right? So it's probably something like Donald Duck and the Zombie. Well, this is interesting. In French, its first publication in French was not till 1976. And it was called Donald et le Tignouf, because later on it was called just Bombi le Zombie.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so in Italy, we've got Paperino e il Feticcio, and then later on, e il Feticcio Voodoo. So translate says that Feticcio is fetish.
I wonder if it's like referring to the little doll as a fetish.
Right.
In the religious right,
because,
sense of it.
Because that can sometimes be called like a fetish doll, right?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, good point. Okay. I'm going to talk about the story now. So Voodoo Hoodoo opens up with Donald walking throughout Duckburg and overhearing people talking about a zombie that's been sighted in town. And this page really sets this up as something that everyone is talking about. Donald is just overhearing it at this point. It's setting up this very creepy atmosphere. And eventually he's going to talk to Bop Bop, who we mentioned. Donald is going to kind of ridicule everyone talking about this zombie sighting until he trips over the actual zombie in the very last panel of the page.
This page had so much going on, right? Yeah. The first panel are some like street sweepers. I thought it was funny that one of them was like sitting down on the fire hydrant. And then the second panel was really cool. It was just like a guy at a food counter. Donald was overhearing him. The third panel made me crack up because it was these very fancy, wealthy ladies with furs.
Yeah.
And one of them says to the other, "A zombie? He should be jailed." And then the other one says, "What for? He hasn't done anything but walk around sleepy-eyed." And the first thought I had was every white woman who calls the cops on a black person just for existing.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. This first woman is definitely that person. And then the second woman, you know, she is offering up this mild defense and pointing out he hasn't committed a crime. He's just existing. Right.
First one is a not in my backyard. And the second one is maybe not in my backyard.
Yeah, exactly. And I remember distinctly when I read this one as a kid, I was horrified by high society lady number one's just incredible nose. It really disturbed me.
Well, all of the wrinkles around her mouth, like you can just see what a bitter, frowny woman she is.
Yeah, she's grotesque. And I think Barks literally drew her nose so that she could turn it up at Donald, mm-hmm. and at the zombie. And, you know, the original printing has them colored weirdly dark, because in reprints, mm-hmm. they depict them as the very white women that they are.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get to Bop Bop, right? We already talked a little bit about Bop Bop, but it's, again, I really think that this is Barks, his intent here, and this is going to sound like a defense of him, but his intent here is to show that Donald is actually very comfortable talking with him, and to maybe peg Donald as a little bit of an outcast himself, right? Because he's talking with a jazz musician very comfortably in a very familiar manner. You know, he knows Bop Bop very well, obviously. So there's a lot going on in these two panels of Donald just interacting casually with this black jazz musician.
Yeah, it's extremely problematic in that he's drawn with that minstrel white mouth, mm. and then his dialogue, which I'm not even going to read. I don't feel comfortable enough even reading that.
Right.
It's very that old-timey Gone with the Wind era.
Oh, like Amos and Andy or something, right?
Yeah. And so, you know, what do? We tend to go to our black friends because they're experts on, you know, XYZ, which is generally a microaggression, because we're generally coming to them for, "Oh, you're a black guy. Please tell me about this question I have about rap," right? You know, it's just,
right.
It's generally like horrible things, horrible examples of microaggressions when we go to people who are Black and ask them questions about things. But I thought it was really interesting. He was like, hey, Bop, you're an expert on ghost stuff. What is a zombie? And I thought that was just like okay, it just happens that Bop is an expert on ghost stuff.
You're right. It's not the fact, he's not approaching him ostensibly because he's Black.
Because he's just an expert on ghost stuff. Because they're friends. You have an extremely good point. Like, he's just chatting with his friend.
These two panels are doing a lot of heavy lifting. And there is, it may be a little tortured, but there is a progressive read on them. You know, it's very dated and it's problematic in and of itself. But, you know, Barks, I think that what he is intending here is to say, Donald does not have a problem with Black people. Right. Donald has an issue with the voodoo curse that he's been placed on, that's been placed on him.
I think it's maybe the 1940s way of saying, I don't see color.
Yeah.
In that it's your intentions are so good. And I know what you mean, but your execution is very lacking.
And then, so Bop is also shown as very juvenile too, is my read on it, right? Because he's on this little tiny motorbike. And so that was part of my read, was like, oh, you're very childish, right? You like ghost stories. And then I know we're spending a lot of time on this page, but you know, Donald, again, he trips over, we're going to learn that it's Bombi the zombie. And you know, tell me, Sarah, a little bit about your impressions, just visually, but also stylistically of Bombi.
So Bombi's wearing, he's very tall. He has these long, hanging, drooping arms, almost like a great ape. And he's dark skinned. He has ring piercings in his nose. His earlobes are stretched out. His clothes, his white shirt thing is tattered, and he has something white on his head. That actually shows up on some of the characters when they get to Africa. And I'm not sure, was that supposed to be an afro and the colorist missed it?
I think it is. I think
kind of a hat.
Well, I think it shows. No, I think it's his hair. It's just he's very old, right? He's been around for a long time. So he's got white hair at this point.
Okay.
Yeah. And he's just got this like very dead looking gaze, right? And we've got a little background of someone looking at him in puzzlement or terror.
Mm-hmm. Out a window.
Yeah. Right. So on the next page, Donald, you know, interacts with him, and he pretty quickly realizes that this guy doesn't look like he's alive. And the zombie, he reaches out and he hands Donald a doll, like a fright doll. Britain has this like history of these dolls called, can I say it? Gollywogs? Is it? So I it reminds me of what the like very popular in the sort of Commonwealth countries would call a gollywog, these old dolls. Look up really quick.
Oh God.
Doesn't it look like
okay. That? Yeah, I was wondering, I looked up voodoo dolls, I looked up these kind of carved wooden dolls, the voodoo dolls, which, as you said earlier, are generally not used in the practice of voodoo.
Right.
But there is another kind of doll that's based on a Western Central African doll. And I looked all over, played around in Wikipedia, couldn't figure out what that was, and there you go.
Yeah, so I didn't see that referenced anywhere, but that's what the doll reminded me of. And these were, you know, pretty popular for a long time, especially in I think the UK and Australia. And you know, it's interesting, this story never goes into sort of the classic voodoo, you know, controlling someone through a doll, even though it has a voodoo doll. So I wonder, that must have been a trope that wasn't really in place, or that's just not what he was interested in. But anyway, Bombi, or the zombie at this point, he hands him the doll, and then he just kind of walks away. And, you know, Donald kind of puzzles over this doll and kind of reconciles, oh, well, he's just some screwball. I'm going to take it home, show the kids. They'll get a kick out of it.
And then as the zombie's walking away, Donald realizes, oh, everybody's afraid of it and running away. I wonder if that's the zombie.
I like that image of the incredibly white looking woman, right? Blonde haired young white woman running in terror. We haven't even talked about this as kind of a subtext for what was happening in America at the time, right? Is that Black people were moving into the suburbs. And I don't think that, I don't think anyone consciously thinks that they're going to write a story about that. But would you think that this is, that there's some subtext for this?
I don't know, since I'm not, I don't know a lot about what was going on in the US at that time.
You know, the GI Bill was, mm-hmm. was just starting to make this popular for some of this mobility. So I think this is some of the subtext here. On the following page, Donald gets home. He's not scared at all at this point. He looks very placid and he presents the doll to the nephews. And one of them, you know, I'm just going to quote it. He says, "It's an ugly thing. Squeeze it. Maybe it goes bebop or something." Donald gives it a quick squeeze and he immediately recoils in pain, saying that there was a thorn in it that stuck his thumb. And he very quickly feels faint and collapses. And the nephews freak out. They say that they need to call a doctor because Uncle Donald's been poisoned, right? It's a very colloquial way of saying poisoned. I like this page. You know, it's some cool storytelling. It's very frightening, I think. You know, his fainting spell looked very frightening and very threatening to me. When I read this as a kid, I should note, this scared me a lot.
Mm.
All right. Oh man, this next page again, there's a lot of storytelling really quickly in this one. You know, we get this newsboy doing a classic extra, read all about the guy what got poisoned by a voodoo doll. That's great dialogue. we've got your society ladies. Do you want to tell me a little bit about their interaction here?
The Karen one is that zombie gave him the doll. I knew he was up to no good. And then the other one out of nowhere is just saying, they say Donald Duck is turning to brass. Like, so I'm just so confused about why this information got to the newsboy and then around everybody in the town. In the next couple of panels, Uncle Scrooge is reading about it in the newspaper while he's sitting in a bath full of his money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then Uncle Scrooge, you know, immediately pays Donald a visit and takes a look at that doll and references, boy, that's quite a story. And he does actually say the words voodoo hoodoo. And the thing about turning to brass is weird to me. I think that must have just been a kind of joke about how stubborn Donald is. That's how I've always read it. But I admittedly didn't look that up.
You know, there's so much going on that I didn't either. And there's so much that I don't understand from this generation. I just was like, that must be something they just said back then.
Yeah.
But, you know, then the first Karen Society lady had her own panel just dedicated to her saying, sniff, he hasn't far to go. He was already solid from the neck up.
Yeah.
Like super ableist commentary on his intelligence. But she's just drawn so specifically with all of those wrinkles and that nose that's clawing downward almost.
Yeah.
She's just a very specific drawing, isn't she?
She is very specific. Yeah. That she kind of lives rent-free in my head. She's drawn so it's saying a lot how much she stuck with me in this story that has a zombie and a witch doctor and a shrunken man.
So spoilers.
Yeah. So we go on to the next page where Scrooge starts to reveal that this was a curse that was intended for him, and it was meant to shrink him about the size of a rat. And, you know, Scrooge is not showing very much empathy here. This is the more villainous version of Scrooge that Barks is going to pretty quickly course correct here. You know, he hadn't figured out what kind of character he wanted to make him, but this is just about his most villainous. You know, and this is going to start Donald's complete freak out. You know, Donald's going to be very terrified and cowardly and preoccupied for most of the rest of this story. And I didn't really talk about that version of the characters. That's something that's been interesting me. You know, Donald's role here is now to be scared and desperate for the rest of the story. And Scrooge is one of the antagonists, but he's never like quite represented as a pure villain in this one, even though the kind of references that he makes to his history, you know, paint him in a very villainous light. Because he says, some old enemies of mine wanted to give me the works, but Donald here gets the works instead. And he laughs at that. And, you know, Donald kind of fights him and he starts to tell more about the story.
Yeah, I wasn't sure how, whether this was just like normal slapstick, like, ha ha, I'm Uncle Scrooge and I think poorly of everybody, or if he was really just a bad guy, because he doesn't just make fun of Donald and say, ha ha, you're getting this punishment that was meant for me, and here's what it is. But then he just goes on to talk about how he, this on this next page, it's just another one of those where the yikes per page count is extremely high. And right. he describes this rubber plantation that he wanted to buy in Africa, and he refers to the people who lived there as ferocious savages. Their voodoo dogs prized the ground, and they wouldn't sell, so I hired a mob of thugs and chased the tribe into the jungle. Like, he's so proud of himself for these horrible acts. But how I don't know if those acts and that language would have been seen as bad as they were back in 1949.
Right. Exactly, right? Because we're at the tail end of colonialism, where basically countries were doing exactly what Scrooge said here. And I think it was probably perceived more as rascally than villainous, right? Because of the legacy of this. But this is a real problem for fans of Scrooge McDuck, right? Because this is a really terrible depiction of him. This is like robber baron. You know, it does not square with how he describes himself later in his most iconic story, Only a Poor Old Man, that I made my fortune by being smarter than the smarties and tougher than the toughies, and I made it square, right? And that's really key to the Scrooge mythos and what people love about Scrooge McDuck, you know, that he's this scrappy self-made quadrillionaire who still has this moral compass. So there is no canon Scrooge McDuck in these comics, but I would say that one, which appeared in Uncle Scrooge number one, is the closest that you get, right? Because it kind of set Barks' blueprint. So Barks was happy to change his characters around, alter them as he saw fit. And for this little span of stories here, you know, you also did Race to the South Seas with me, right? Where he had hired kind of some people that he viewed as savages again to protect him. So we're in this relatively brief window where he's like this robber baron, and his point is to be greedy and unscrupulous. And later, his point is to be greedy, but self-made in a more noble way. So this story has given a lot of people pause. You know, I this is a big digression, but Don Rosa is kind of regarded as like Karl Barks' heir. And he did a really big project called The Life and Times of Scrooge McDuck, where he kind of went back and he tried to kind of commerge all of the details that were referenced in the Barks stories about how Scrooge made his fortune and make this really sprawling, fascinating story of this Scottish kid who emigrated and made his fortune. And, you know, Rosa talks a lot about how he was going to deal with voodoo hoodoo. And he talks in his notes about, you know, he debated throwing it out. And then he decided that it was going to be Scrooge's one bad act that he always regretted. And, you know, we can talk about, I'll probably get into it later if I ever get around to those stories and talk about whether Rosa should have thrown this one out. But it's really interesting to me that, you know, he had to really stop and think about, you know, am I going to treat this as canon? And again, this is a really packed page, right? Scrooge talks about this curse, right? That the witch doctor who was enraged at Scrooge's theft of the land, which, you know, Scrooge himself is basically acknowledging, I stole that land. He put a poison thorn in the doll and sent old Bombi the zombie, we learn his name there, to track me down, and that Bombi has been after him for 70 years in this story. And, you know, the timeline doesn't really work, but yeah, the idea is that he's been after him for a very, very long time. We also get a little bit of lore about Bark's version of a zombie, right? Zombies don't think, and that they can only remember one thing at a time.
I did want to point out in that final panel on that page where in the flashback, young Uncle Scrooge is walking away from the witch doctor and the zombie, and he's walking on this path, and there are two signposts, one pointing in the direction that Scrooge is walking, and it says lightest Africa, and then the one pointing behind him where he was leaving from, where the zombie and the witch doctor are, says darkest Africa.
Yeah. And he's got a very like colonialist pith helmet on. So on the next page, you know, Donald, we kind of get into Donald being super worried about the curse and wondering, and he's basically starting to imagine himself shrinking already. And, you know, Uncle Scrooge advises the nephews to just give him a sleeping pill and let him sleep it off. And, you know, we kind of transition now over to the nephew's point of view, and we're going to get a lot of their point of view for the rest of the story. At this point, it's almost a Huey, Dewey, Louie story, because they're starting to get creeped out about zombies, because there's very ominous in the last panel. They're laying in bed and one of them says, "Say, I wonder what became of that zombie." And the middle nephew says, "Shut up. Now you're giving me nightmares."
And you know, when they're nonplussed, that like something's up, like, because right, they're usually the ones who keep their wits about them.
Exactly right. They're meant to be avatars for Bark's readers. They're the young boys that are clever, imagining themselves reading this comic. So yeah, I'm getting creeped out at this point when I read this at age 8, and especially the next page is super creepy. You know, we transition, we see the at City Hall, the police officers are kind of feeling helpless to do anything about the zombie because no one's filed a complaint. And then now we have this really cool panel of Bombi in silhouette, Bark's narration panel, talking about him going to the residential section of the city, and that some mysterious instinct has him stop in front of Donald's house where he's peacefully snoring. And finally at dawn, you know, Donald wakes up and he's feeling a little bit better. Maybe he slept it off. Maybe it was all a dream. And when he opens his eyes, he sees Bombi just very placidly standing at the foot of his bed. And he lets out what is easy to imagine as an unearthly screech based on the way that Barks has drawn that word balloon. This is a great page, right? This page is giving a very creepy atmosphere. And regardless of all the problematic bones that it's built on, I do like this page a lot. And so the nephews come running on the next page. They see what they figure out must be the zombie. They start to attack him with brooms, but Bombi doesn't react to anything. And so they kind of wear themselves out and they're like, okay, he doesn't seem to be a threat to us. So they ask Donald what he did. And Donald says, "Nothing, but he gives me the creeps." And the nephews figure out pretty quickly that, you know, he's actually harmless. One of them comments, he just looks lonesome. And, you know, they figure out, well, he can't talk. Most likely He seems to be lost. And so the nephews size him up pretty quickly. So on the next page, you know, the nephews are really starting to empathize with Bombi. They're figuring, you know, maybe he wants to go back to Africa, back to his voodoo people. And, you know, one of them sums it up really nicely, that he's been trying to deliver this doll for 70 years. And now that he's completed this task, he doesn't know what to do with himself. And one of them tears up in empathy. And then surmises that he's come back to Donald because it's the only link he has with his own world. And Donald's like, don't feel sympathy for him. So they, why don't you go ahead and describe the rest of this page?
They just grab Bombi by the hand and lead him around, and Bombi follows them. And one of them says, watch how he lets me lead him around by the hand. And then another one says, maybe he understands kindness. And I love that so much.
Yeah.
Like, I do love a monster who just like is misunderstood. That's a really good way to kind of diffuse any of these tense situations. And it, you know, in your own brain, it's a good way to take control of your fantasy life and where just something isn't as scary anymore. And so I thought that was a really great way to put the kids back in control. And kindness, aww, you know, I love some kindness.
Yeah, this is a great way to diffuse it, right? The story just got a little bit less scary. And you're right, the like misunderstood monster is a great trope.
Try to feed him, but he doesn't want anything to eat.
Yeah. So the nephews become very sympathetic here, but you know, Donald is very single-minded. On the next page, he's freaking out. He's constantly perceiving himself as getting shorter. And he resolves to ask Uncle Scrooge to demand passage to Africa to see the witch doctor to lift the curse. And then the nephews kind of figure out, oh, you know, maybe there's a trip to Africa in it for us as well.
I did think it was cute that I think I pointed this out in another episode where Donald is unclothed, but he's wearing a towel that covers up the areas that his clothes usually don't cover up.
That's right.
And somehow he feels modest that way.
Oh, yeah. And that's not just a Barks thing. That's just kind of how everyone who works with Donald treats him. You can see him in the cartoons wrapping a towel around his lower half. All right. So on the next page, and very uncharacteristically, Uncle Scrooge immediately agrees to pay to have him go to Africa. And, you know, Donald is in this pose of like both terror and supplication, and he's just looking desperate. And Scrooge points out that, you know, I'd certainly rather pay your fare to Africa than have you haunting me the rest of your life with your imaginary hoodoo. And there's a lot in that, but he gives him the price for a single ticket to Africa. And when Donald gets back and lets the kids down by saying only he can go, the kids, you know, they have a little bit of a tantrum, and Bombi has some sympathy tears. And Donald, you know, packs a little carpet bag and immediately leaves the boys all alone while he's going to be in Africa for weeks, with no more advice than keep the lawn mowed and the petunias watered.
That's such bad parenting. I felt so bad because that was the first time I've ever seen the boys get upset.
It is, but it's also, it happens enough in these stories that I think it's meant to be like a little bit of an audience empowerment, right? Like I trust the kids to be home by themselves, because there are times in a lot of these that the nephews will do very adult things like drive cars, to say nothing of how often they save Donald. So the nephews wear themselves out crying, and they decide that they're going to take Zombi into town to see about getting him back to Africa. And they dress him up in some pretty, pretty ridiculous clothes. One of them is like a very old military garb or something. And the nephews, they kind of get distracted talking about the situation. And before they realize it, they have outwalked Zombi by the time they get to the immigration office. It cracks me up that they think that the immigration office can maybe do something for him, but But yeah, they lose sight of Bombi. So the kids on the next page, they backtrack and follow a crowd of people into a broadcast studio, which turns out to be the a taping of the Perky Peanut Quiz Show. And they do notice Bombi on the stage with the contestants. So they sit down to watch. And we've got this like very late 40s radio host who's quite a character. And this is a very like high concept, very over the top sequence, right? Where he is going to give some quiz questions to Zombi. And we got that like comedy of errors where by not answering, by not saying anything, he's going to correctly win the quiz show. And by the end, by the end of the next page, he's going to win the grand prize of a wheelbarrow full of money, thus securing his and the kids' passage to Africa. It's pretty funny. It's very silly. It's a good little device to get them on their way to Africa in a really over the top, wealthy manner. So any comments for that and the next page?
I'm looking up the exchange rate because he wins $100 for that first question.
Right. Is a red. Red.
Which is about, you know, $1,050.
And who can look up the exchange rate for a wheelbarrow full of money? Because wheelbarrow full of pennies is different from, but it's a nationwide contest. So, you know, obviously enough fare to get them to Africa in grand style, and then to have these problematic wads of cash around to just grease the wheels on their way. All right, so we transitioned to Africa, where Donald's just arrived. And, you know, he is kind of thinking about how pretty it is there. He's thinking about how little money he has to survive on while he looks for the witch doctor. And then before he leaves the airport, everyone's attention turns to another plane. Do you want to describe the next plane, Sarah?
It's quite a bit larger than Donald's little dinky puddle jumper.
Oh, you know what? Some very enthusiastic listener has actually been emailing me or commenting on the Facebook page, rather. He seems to be very interested in aviation and the Karl Barks comics. And he's been sharing with me the names of some of these planes.
Nice.
Intriguingly. Listener Ruben Olsrud has been sharing information about these planes. And the plane that the ducks arrive in is a Boeing B-52, which is the only 8-engine aircraft that have been produced regularly.
Donald arrives and he's getting off his plane. He has a surprisingly human-looking stewardess, I noticed. But the announcements go on at the airfield and clear the runway, special chartered super luxury liner coming in from America with 8 engines and silver fox upholstery.
A great detail.
1, 2, 3, 4. How do you even get 8 engines? I'm just, that sounds pretty fantabulous. And given that they took off quite a bit later than Donald did, you know, those 8 engines would definitely make them arrive only a few minutes afterward.
That's right.
And then Donald decides that he's going to stick around and see what that is. And it's the kids and Bombi the zombie. And the kids are all dressed up like fancy, putting on the Ritz guys with canes and white spats. And Bombi the zombie, they all have top hats. And money, of course, is flying everywhere because that's what happens when you're that wealthy.
Right. And I think it's very thoughtful that they have secured a rich tycoon outfit for Bombi as well.
It's definitely an upgrade from the outfit that they had secured for him in the previous page.
Right. Yeah. So they did what they could. And I like the little gag where one of the onlookers says, must be some fabulously rich potentate. I've never heard the word potentate outside of a few of these Barks comics.
The landing wheels have leopard skin tires.
Yeah. All right. So there's a narration box that does a lot of work here, right? It says money talks, and soon Bombi's fortune has talked up a whole safari complete with folding bathtubs and eager to plunge into the African bush. So, you know, they're going to stop off at Scrooge's Rubberville, a rubber plantation, which, you know, they nicknamed Scroogeville on the latex. That's a fun gag. And there's, you know, it's a neat little panel of them traveling with a lion kind of in the distance. When they talk to the manager at the rubber plantation, he basically warns him off. He says that they're hidden very well. The police can't find him, and they terrorize the locals every few weeks. And when Donald says he has to ask him a favor, the manager basically wishes him goodbye and says it was nice knowing you. And I'm not going to go too deeply into it, but the history of European and Americans getting rubber in Central Africa is really, really brutal. And the fact that Scrooge has a rubber plantation out here, one of the more horrific chapters in colonialism is what the Belgians did in the quote Belgian Congo, extracting rubber. So you don't want to be involved with rubber in Central Africa. All right. So embarking on their safari, you know, they get deeper into the bush, and Donald has a conversation with one of the with the leader of the safari. You know, the expedition leader is kind of cautioning them. They need to camp out, and then they'll head closer to where the village is believed to be the next day. And he's very fearful and says that, you know, we can't let the voodoo villagers see us first. In the reprint that I read as a kid, you know, they omit his little "oh lawsy lawsy," which is like something that basically people imagined, you know, uneducated blacks saying.
Yeah, isn't that supposed to be an African from Africa? Why is he using...
Right. Yeah, it's definitely...
African-American vernacular English.
Yeah, it doesn't fit, really.
Or like, you know, a bastardization of AAVE.
Yeah, exactly. And so while the safari is at rest, suddenly an arrow strikes a tree behind them with one of the voodoo dolls dangling from it. And it makes everyone is just immensely terrified. And on the next page, you see the whole safari just fleeing in terror for their lives. So, you know, the ducks have been abandoned. They are on their own in the African bush. They realize, you know, that the voodoo village knows that they're here, and, you know, the nephews are debating whether they should turn back. And I guess I like that, you know, he's creating some real tension here, but it also is kind of depicting these people as like basically easily scared. It's not a great representation.
No, and they have the white around their mouths kind of minstrel depiction. And are they African? Are they African Americans? Are they just like people who've decided that, like, oh, I'm a local, but I'm afraid of this other local because he's so fearsome, and that's how we're supposed to interpret how fearsome,
right,
whatever his name is. Who are these people?
Yeah, I think these are the non-voodoo villagers, right? And this is kind of Barks raising the stakes to show us how ferocious this other feared people are. And, you know, their depiction is basically like, this is what all the creators were doing. It was a trope. It was as good of an example as a trope as you can find, almost, right? Because this caricature doesn't reflect reality at all, but this is just how all comic creators somehow this like filtered out to everyone, right? I read Asterix comics from this same era. This is how they were represented. The Floyd Gottfredson Mickey Mouse comic strip from this time, this is how they were represented. And I think this is just one of those weird universal shorthands that has dated very poorly for very obvious reasons, but wouldn't have looked weird at the time at all because everyone was doing it. All right. So on the following page, you know, they're just having a conversation about their next step. They get the idea to ask Bombi to lead them to the village. And while they're having this conversation, something overhears them from in a little tuft, a little bush. Some voice says, "Did I hear somebody mention zombies? I'm an authority on the subject." And we get this little reveal, this little tiny man steps out and says that he has just been to the hideout of old Fula Zula, the witch doctor. And, you know, I hadn't mentioned his name before that, and it doesn't feel great to say it out loud, but it is the name, right? It rhymes. It's catchy. It sticks in your head. It also seems to be a play on the word Zulu. So,
and fool.
But I don't think fool like idiot, right? I think fool like fool you, right? Like trick you, like he's crafty and conniving. That's my read on it, at least.
I could see both arguments standing.
So this is kind of a cool reveal. You know, this is what they used for the cover image, basically the ducks boggling at meeting this tiny little man. And we immediately understand that he's been victimized by the same curse that Donald has. And he goes on to introduce himself as Cornelius McCobb. He's a researcher from the University of Ypsilanti. And he says that while he's kind of sitting down, and we get some cool little details of insects next to him while he's sitting on a twig, he talks about how he came to research voodoo science. So this is kind of Bark's veering a little bit from the magic aspect to the science aspect of it, because he generally liked to not leave these things as supernatural. You know, every once in a while there was a supernatural element to these stories, but for the most part, it was explained. He thought that he had befriended the witch doctor, but one day he gave him a doll and told him to squeeze it, and we know what happens. And he reveals to Donald that, you know, he still has a day to go based on his understanding of the timeline of the voodoo drug. So the professor's really interesting, right? I feel like he leaves a big impact for the like three or so pages that he's on, because he's like become a convert to his shrunken lifestyle. He's extolling how little resources he needs to live. He's really excited to be small. I'm going to say that he does not have a family, because I don't think they're going to be as excited about it. But Donald, I mean, is
if
not...
they were millennials, they would be so stoked to be able to build a mansion out of a trunk.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Millennial dream is just to own any property at all. So like, yeah, to build a whole house out of a trunk.
Yeah, you can have a palatial.
Still my beating heart.
Donald is not sold though, and he snatches the map that the professor helpfully draws for him, using a pencil that's taller than he is. And as they're about to leave, he comments, and on to the next page, you know, don't let that zombie fool you. He's not really, quote, done for or dead, as some of the reprints corrected. He's just been drugged. He doesn't need to sleep or eat or feel anything. And again, he's like suggesting all in all, they're very well off. You know, this is a horrifying condition, of course, to be in. So, but we know that this guy's excited about being the size of a rat. So maybe he's not the most reliable narrator.
It's fine to take their agency. They're fine. Don't worry about it.
Sure. And he indicates that, you know, after several centuries, the drug wears off and they'll be normal people again. And the kids are very sweet. They're very excited for him being a man with a future. You know, I'm not sure how well his future is going to go waking up in, you know, say 2021 or whatever, and having it wear off and friends and family are all gone. Anyway, the ducks eventually arrive at the hidden village, you know, which is like a classic palisade wall. And when they bang on the door, trap door opens up beneath him, and they're kind of secreted forward along this dark tunnel. And when it's not dark anymore, they appear right before last time Fula Zula himself, who greets them by saying, "Good afternoon, Scrooge McDuck." And the witch doctor is like terrifying here, right, Sarah?
You know, he really is. The whole minstrel, like, white mouth thing is often done to make Black people seem less intelligent and maybe
less threatening,
more emotional than rational, I think, in a lot of ways. But the way that they've drawn his eyebrows and his other face paint and his teeth, especially his kind of pointy teeth. And then he's also got these snakes wrapped around his arms, and he's kind of taking that, like, feet together kind of butterfly pose, and his hands are clasped in front of him. Like, he's just like, yes, you know, if he were Burns, he would be tapping his fingertips at each other.
Yeah. And on the next page, he's kind of leaning forward like a vulture. So he's truly terrifying. And that's what Barks was going for, right? So, like, I would say it's both an offensive caricature, but also, like, very successful, because he's scary. And he has very sharpened teeth in this one. They kind of corrected that in later printings, censored/corrected, whatever you want to. Whatever your point of view is.
I also get a little bit of queer coding in the way that Jafar and Scar have these very kind of, like, pointed eyebrows that effeminize them a little bit.
Yeah. And he's just super malevolent. Oh, the other thing, right, is that he does not speak with caricaturized dialogue at all.
That's a good point.
He's very sharp, maybe the smartest, maybe
he's absolutely the smartest person there.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Right. So, you know, Donald on the next page is taken aback. He's like, I'm not Scrooge. I'm just some guy who looks like him. Scrooge is very old, you know, and the witch doctor considers this and realizes with disgust that he's right. And Donald, you know, explains what happened, that he got the curse intended for Scrooge McDuck. He points out he never did anything to hurt you. And the witch doctor acknowledges that this mistake has been made. He is shrewd and he is villainous. So he wheedles with him, you know, how much is it worth for you to be saved by me? And the nephews step in and they pull out several wads of Bombi's fortune and ask, is it worth this much, Mr. Zula? They say. And he rifles the wad and says, $20,000. I guess the only time he does say wowsy, that might be a little bit of a character, but he says, That for that comfortable fee, I am very willing to de-voodoo your hoodoo. It's kind of funny dialogue, but again,
are two separate religions.
Yeah. and so, you know, he goes on to say, you know, as a matter of fact, you don't really have anything to worry about, because in all honesty, the doll lost its power many years ago. So Donald feels much better. He instantly knows he can be happy again. He doesn't have to worry. And as he is leaving, he very foolishly says goodbye to the witch doctor and tells the kids, we've got a swell story to tell Uncle Scrooge. I love the panel of the witch doctor processing that he just said, Uncle. I like his expression there. And, you know, Donald is very proud of being Scrooge's nearest living relative. But when they learn that, of course, they immediately grab onto him. And the witch doctor explains that it's voodoo law that the nearest of kin can atone for the sins of a wrongdoer. And he immediately starts to make a new batch of super shrimp.
That just seems like, I mean, I didn't look up to see whether that is a true tenet of voodoo or hoodoo or any of the religions that they are based on.
I think
it's definitely meant to be menacing, right? Yeah. It's definitely supposed to cast them as evil,
right? What do you call that? What's the term for someone else taking a person's punishment? That's something that we tend to view as, like, very cowardly and very evil. So the nephews are talking with the witch doctor while he is making up the potion. You know, I find it interesting that they don't capture the nephews or anything. They're just left to their own devices. There's this very menacing panel where the witch doctor brandishes the potion and says, "This time the medicine will be fresh." Very scary. And they escape over the palisade wall, and they are stopped by a villager who brandishes a spear at them and just kind of casually and menacingly asks them, "Going shopping?" And one of the nephews says, "Yes, will you sell us the spear for $10,000? And so it's very interesting here that, like, money solves all their problems, right? Money is their weapon for the rest of this story.
And it's not even their money. Like, right. Not only are these people super greedy in a way that they probably aren't in those regions in real life, but they're just like, yeah, Bobby doesn't have any agency of his own. We're just going to spend his money for him.
Right. And I guess one could argue, you know, that they're helping him out by returning to his homeland. It's a very paternalistic view. But but again, I'll just point that out because I do like, you know, we're meant to identify with the nephews. So I won't overlook their blind spots. But they definitely come out better than Donald or Scrooge in this story.
It is a little bit off-putting that in the next panel, at the top of the next page, that man says, $10,000 for that kind of money, you can buy me too, which is just so cringy, considering that
right.
owning African men is...
Considering the legacy.
Right.
So as a kid, I thought that was just hilarious dialogue. I thought that was so funny because it was so absurd to me, right? It didn't immediately dawn on me that that might be a reference to slavery. And it's never, you know, directly mentioned. It's just something that you can't help but think about as a grown adult. But I find it fascinating that I've transitioned from having that reaction, like, what an absurd statement. That's so funny.
Yeah.
Who, as you say, just utterly cringing when I read this one. And so,
you know, would it have been absurd? Would it have been, oh, this is nowhere near reality and therefore funny to a reader in 1949, right?
Yeah. And I mean, it hasn't been too many pages since they commissioned a whole safari full of Africans and they were paying them, but I can't imagine it was like the kind of wage.
They did give them top hats.
Yeah. And you know, the guy called him Bwana, which is the Swahili word for master.
Oh.
That was, you know, that was the common trope for safaris though. So anyway, this villager says that he's heading to Cape Town to go shopping. Kind of loaded, right? Because Cape Town is South Africa, one of the only white controlled places in Africa and probably thousands of miles away. So the nephews are free to go help Donald. They need to keep track of the moon because the witch doctor is going to perform this spell at its zenith. This is where I learned the word zenith. So I thought that was cool. They run all the way back to Scroogeville, but they discover that there's no one available to help because a note says the whole crew has gone to a movie in Wambo Jambo and they've left everything thoroughly padlocked. They can't find any good weapons here at all.
They do like their rhyme schemes, don't they?
Yes, Sparks will use a lot of these rhyme schemes. It's sticky, right? It's memorable. It's funny. I'm there for it. Definitely.
I'm not sure about Wambo Jambo though, because or Wambo Jambo or whatever. Jambo is a Swahili greeting.
Yes, that's.
And true. So he's taking these words. I mean, it's not just like random syllables. I'm all for a good rhyme, but
right. And to be completely fair, he'll do this in every language, including European ones. But it definitely comes off with that like African ease connotation. So on the next page, you know, out of frustration, they kick one of the slabs of rubber that's lying around the plantation, and it just bounces all over the place, upsets a pile of them. And they note that they bounce like they're crazy. And now they have this moment of realization that, you know, maybe they have some kind of tool that they can use. They each haul a slab of rubber and head back into the bush. And we transition to Donald back in the village. He is in a bullpen awaiting his fate, and he's just kind of stewing in his own misery, cursing himself for bragging about Scrooge being his uncle and waiting to be I do like his little invocation, then I'll be shrunk to a size to fit my brain.
Yeah,
yeah.
I did like how the kids, I just, you know, I love kindness. I love cooperation. I love these kids and how they're all, hey, you know, at the same time.
Yeah.
They get the same idea. They barely have to communicate it. They're on the same page and they're like, yeah, let's go with it.
That's a good point, right? The kids always have a lot of like empathy with each other throughout this story. It's kind of one of the bright spots in it.
Yeah.
And, you know, on the next page, Donald is just feeling ever more sorry for himself. At one point he starts crying out loud, Daisy won't love me anymore. And he starts to sob, which is very sad, right? Like when the fact that he thinks that because he's shrunk, he's not going to merit being loved. All right. So the witch doctor pokes his head through an opening and he says, now, are you sorry your rich uncle drove us from our voodoo lands? And Donald just says, no. And if it's going to be any comfort to you to know it, I'm going to punch your fat nose. Just a terrible exchange. Two people being terrible to each other. I mean, the witch doctor has been like incredibly wronged, right? Like their lands were stolen.
Right. And
he's still awful. And he's been wrong. It's just, it's not a sympathetic depiction at all. It's just,
yeah, he's like the Killmonger of this story, right? Like he's not wrong.
Right.
But his methods are questionable.
Yeah. Yes. You know, you don't.
Know, we all have to think about how we've benefited from the wrong our ancestors did. But in this case, Donald really hasn't benefited because Uncle Scrooge is such a to him.
Yeah, he does. So it certainly greases his wheels sometimes. And he has benefited in this story in his pride, right? His sense of pride. But other than that, no. So anyway.
Yeah. Like they should be on the same team. Like they should just be buddies and be like, you know what? Let's team up and take some of those quadrillions.
Well, and there was that moment when they first encountered each other where the witch doctor was like not going to like mindlessly attack him if he wasn't a threat, right? Like he was like, oh, you're just someone who's my read of it is that he was going to see what he could scrounge and let him go free. So he was sympathetic up until the point where he's going to do this.
Mm-hmm.
So the nephews arrive and they get set up with their rubber slabs. And, you know, this is a very tense scene where the timing is everything. And this is pretty cool. I think this is a neat part of the story where the witch doctor is waiting for the moon to reach its zenith before he forces Donald to squeeze the new doll. The nephews are setting up in a tree outside the stockade. They tie themselves to the rubber slab as the witch doctor is counting down on the clock. They start to bounce into the palisade. And right at the moment where he's supposed to conduct the new curse, they snatch Donald and bounce away to safety.
Mm-hmm.
And on the next page, they continue to bounce out. The villagers set off after them. And, you know, they're definitely not out of danger. They have to scurry away, but they take the rubber slabs in case they're useful. Donald leads them up to a steep path that the villagers will have to come single file. And so they're in pretty big trouble because they're armed with those spears. But just then they see that that Bombi has tracked them down. And Donald's very excited to see him. He starts to tie Bombi's feet to the rubber slabs, saying that he's doing something smart for a change, and it's about time. And so on the next page, you know, Bombi comes in handy here. He's going to be exploited by the ducks, right? They're using him as a literal weapon. They push him off the cliff. The nephews at least have the good grace to look worried for Bombi, but he bounces down the hillside, stomping on the villagers. And Donald comments, "That does it. If Bombi keeps on bouncing, he'll flatten the whole tribe." He celebrates that he is saved from the hoodoo. They can go home and spend the rest of Bombi's money. The nephews. Do you want to close this out and talk about the nephews and Donald's reflection?
No, go ahead.
The nephews, you know, they're a little bit wistful, saying, "Poor old Bombi." But one of them says, "You know, don't worry about him. He doesn't feel anything. And even if he bounces for a month, he'll still be okay." You know, and they kind of echo the professor's words. Yeah, zombies don't get hungry or thirsty or tired. They really have something. And Donald just comments, "They can take it. They can have it. I'll take vanilla." And, you know, it's this tonal conclusion that says, you know, we're not going to worry about Bombi anymore. We're going to take his money and go home.
And it's just, I didn't realize that was the end.
Right.
I was like, wait, what? What just happened?
Yeah, because it's a very abrupt ending, right?
It is.
I think, you know, Barks was at 32 pages, and I don't think there's only one time he gets to go longer than that. So I think he may have kind of run out of story, but we've got the central conflict resolved. The only thing that is kind of left, I don't know about you, but right, they say that if you introduce a gun in Act One, it's going to be fired by Act Three. You know, we kind of get teased with the idea that zombies wake up someday, and that Barks doesn't ever pull the trigger on it. He does reference that it could be hundreds of years in the future, and they talk about his tunic looking like it went through the sack of Rome, sacking of Rome. So we know that his time frame is very long, but obviously he was not interested in Bombi waking up or in Bombi as a character. Bombi is, and I don't want to forget to say, I really like Bombi in this story. You know, he's obviously a problematic character, tremendously problematic, but he's also very sympathetic, right? And he does kind of have this like soulful, morose expression that to me makes him very sympathetic. I don't know about you.
Yeah, considered that he's basically just an object for most of the comic, and they just take advantage of him. Everybody takes advantage of him. Zula takes advantage of him. The kids take advantage of his money. They don't even let him keep it. Let's go home and spend Bombi's money. But he's just so down for whatever.
Yeah.
Just like, okay.
I do love the like juxtaposition of him just kind of standing there passively while he's bouncing on this rubber slab. You know, I imagine a real person would be terrified, eyes open wide, bracing themselves. It's a very comical image, right? Him bouncing these people, at least if you don't think about some of the deeper...
If you don't think about the fact that he doesn't have agency and he's being taken advantage of.
Right. And he's being weaponized like an object, like you say.
Right. And that just kind of makes you think about even now, right? Like you were saying earlier, like there is a certain kind of humor that appealed to you as a child because you didn't know any better. but now you do. And so you cringe at it, but there's still, we still have these bits of ourselves that are like, oh, look at this funny exploited Black man with no agency. Ha 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 ha. And we can still find humor in that.
Right.
Instead of just be totally cringy about it. Like, we have so far to go.
So, I mean, I consider, when I read stories like this, I can't help but reflect on that, right? Because I'm not going to deny it. You're absolutely right. You know, enjoying some of the humor in it means that we do have far to go. But I also feel like I can't lie, right? I'm steeped in this culture. Mm-hmm. We're steeped in this culture that has had this kind of storytelling for so long. And the challenge with this story is that it is built on this foundation of these, you know, cultural ideas that Barks grew up in, right? I'm not singling him out. This was pretty much everyone at the time, with some exceptions, but it is built on this foundation that is deeply racist and problematic about these cultures and these religions. And yet this one has some very good artistry and some funny, clever, creative storytelling. And I grew up with it. And it's hard to wholly like divorce yourself from that. So this one has been causing me a lot of angst, right? Because mm-hmm. I'm like, how much of this story do I have to like throw away? How much have I grown up? And it stresses me out a little bit to be reading stories like this and releasing this podcast that has a listenership that does tend to be older. And many, many people listening have probably read this as kids from maybe decades further back than I did, right? And I know for mm-hmm. a lot of people, I heard from people after Volcano Valley that, you know, they didn't really see anything problematic about it. And that's their take on it. And that's fine, but I can't read it without seeing it. And so I want to strike the balance of kind of appreciating the artistry of these stories, but I'm not going to ignore, especially this one. You know, this story is deeply and profoundly offensive.
Yeah, it is.
There are still aspects of it that I, quote, enjoy, but it is literally impossible for me to read it and enjoy the story as a whole, because it is, this one has had the most censoring, I think, of any of his stories, really. And there's a reason for it. And again, these were common storytelling devices at the time. It's just that Barks has such a huge, such a massive collection of well-regarded works that we don't always get to compare his stories to anonymous Marvel Comics writer of the Avengers number 31 or whatever that probably had similarly challenging content. It's just that not every work kind of stands up as something to look back on. And I think that Barks' work, I think that his stories do stand up, at least in terms of their artistry. And most of the stories, fortunately, don't have this kind of grounding, right? But it's impossible not to talk about the problems with this one. So thank you. I know I've been kind of rambling about this one, but I really need to process this story, you know, and I'm really coming down on the fact that you can't responsibly enjoy this one without that asterisk and that sort of, this is entertaining, but.
Right. Now, you're talking about how Barks grew up in this atmosphere where this would be funny, and he wrote in his adulthood stuff based on this type of humor for kids of that era of the next generation to be entertained by and given the reprints throughout the 20th century. It even became part of the fabric of your childhood. Yeah. And you have children of your own.
Yes. And
do you see stuff like this that perpetuates or builds upon or even is still in circulation from earlier times when this stuff was acceptable and funny?
That's a pretty deep, profound question. No, that's a great question, right? Because I think that a lot of the culture that we ingest today is made by people. When you're a kid, you're enjoying culture that was made by adults, right? Even if it's a kid show, it's written by adults. So like, I think about The Simpsons, which I loved growing up and watched as a teenager, right around the same time I was reading these, right? That was written by 30-year-olds who grew up with a lot of these like old sitcom ideas, right? So even if the people that are still producing this content are not directly creating content that's like this, that's the kind of worldview that they've steeped in, right? And so hopefully you move on and hopefully you advance, but at some point you have to like make a decision, I think, internally, right? To do better and to recognize that some of the stuff you consumed in your childhood was rotten, right? It had a rotten core. And this story, I will acknowledge that I think it has some good artistry, some great illustration, some great dialogue, some clever storytelling, but it is rotten at its core, right? Its mm-hmm. foundation is built on a culture that had these ideas. And I think this is an incredible way to like understand what the culture was like at this time, right? This is a kid's story. Mm-hmm. So that would be my answer, right? The stories that you and I are reading and watching today are generally better and they're generally more mindful, but they're made by content creators that may have grown up with stuff like this. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So that's my thought.
Are your kids into like Steven Universe and She-Ra and all of those that have been hailed as just fantastically progressive?
Yeah. You know, especially my oldest. My oldest is very like socially conscious and very actively geared towards equality, leaving the world better, right? And that's something mm-hmm. that is coming easier to the next generation, I think. That's something where like I have to actively try to open my mind to it. But that's the kind of media that he wants to consume, my oldest. And my middle really enjoys it too, like similar stories, but I don't think is quite as like naturally inclined to them. You know, I've read stories to both of those kids. I haven't read this one to either of them. It would be so much work to try to contextualize this one. And I've read some of them that do have some of the challenging content, because I'm always happy to contextualize it. I think it's a great opportunity. This one is just, it is too much work. You could teach a college class on this story.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. When I was doing the reading for Hoodoo Was versus What Voodoo Was, it was just so much just for the context for the title.
Right.
As I've kind of said with every episode you've invited me to be on, it's a fascinating anthropological study of what was going on in that time period.
Yeah, because I think the things that we expect kids to consume, and Barks didn't talk down the way a lot of creators did, but it's a really interesting reflection on society. And this, there's just so much about the history and the legacy of colonialism and racism in this one that I think it's well worth reading, because it's fascinating. But
the rubber stuff that we didn't even have time to go into.
I know. We're going to talk about, I got to go into that general consensus, right? Like I told you at the outset, this one is still pretty well regarded. If you check on Index, this one gets a 7.9 out of 10, which as of today is good for number 49 out of all, you know, roughly 41,000 Disney comics. And if you just pulled out all of the non-Bark stories, I didn't count them, but I'm guessing that would place it in like the low 20s, right? Like, so this is in the upper tier as far as the opinion of fans. That's very highly rated. I've talked extensively already about my feelings of it. There's some fascinating storytelling. There's some truly great dialogue in this one. There's a lot of art. It's Carl Barth, so there's some really great drawings in this one. But ultimately, this well is just too poisoned, right? For me to do anything but read it with this, the yikes factor, right? It's impossible to read it without a disembodied voice yelling yikes every few panels. There is a lithograph, an oil painting. He did do an oil painting version of this one that represents the cover. It's a pretty cool painting. And I do like to mention if DuckTales ever adapted, what do you think?
I feel like it's very cinematic and full of adventure. I would guess yes.
Right. They never did it in the very first series run, the original one. And when I started watching the second one, I got a little bit behind. And, you know, Eric Hartley, who's one of the other hosts, he and I were talking at one point about the new DuckTales. And he said, you know what, in season two, well, he told me they do a take on Bombi the Zombie, not Voodoo Hoodoo.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
And I told him I couldn't believe it. Eric said, no, you know what? They actually handled it pretty well. And I was super skeptical, but they did. What they did is they actually completely removed the voodoo element of this and the curse. They essentially retconned it into a mysterious curse where the richest person in the world at any given time is followed by this force called the Bombi. And it's not a zombie. It's just this kind of monstrous force. And I don't know that they needed to have even bothered. I think it's unadaptable, right? But that is how they chose to do it. And absent the fact that it was called the Bombi, it really had nothing to do with this story. So, you know, that's all right. I don't know that there was really a need to preserve the name Bombi, but they took on the challenge. Yeah. Any panels that you are willing to admit as being a favorite panel or one that you liked?
I guess when you say panel, I think about artistry.
So it's mostly the artistry, but it can also be about the storytelling or really whatever kind of strikes your fancy.
You know, I feel like the Karen ladies, they're hilarious to me.
Yeah.
Rich, gossipy ladies, just contextually.
Yeah. And it's got some very notable character design. I really liked the panel where Donald wakes up with Bombi at the foot of the bed and is just screeching. That was cool. And then I liked the one where the citizens are running in fear.
Mm-hmm.
We've had a ton to say about this one. You know, I thought that one of my favorite stories is the one we did last episode, Lost in the Andes. And I just indulged myself and talked at length about it. And I thought that would be our longest episode, but this one is on track to be our longest. And I don't know, we've had some really great conversations, so I don't know that I want to edit too much of it out. Any closing thoughts, Sarah?
Nope.
So if any listeners want to yell at me for, you know, besmirching the good name of Voodoo Hoodoo, if this is your favorite, you might want to look in the mirror, but you can get in touch with us on Facebook or barksremarks@gmail.com. If I haven't upset you too much, hopefully you will stick around for next episode. I'm going to have a lot of fun talking about a much more lighthearted story, Letter to Santa. And I managed to talk my own wife into joining me for that one. So I'm so excited to bring Suze into the conversation. Thank you very much, Sarah.
Thank you for having me. I always appreciate our conversations.
Excellent.
That's it.
Perfect.